Blog Talk Radio.
Hey, good evening. It's the L.A. Steel Show. And Lila will be with us and joining us in just a few minutes. Tonight, we have an recorded interview with George Dixon. Zuzu on our Friday night shows. Excuse me. And, yes, and we will have that recording in a little while.
We have to some news, fresh news tonight. We had old news last night, so we'll now old today, so we'll have some fresher news.
Maybe some fresher news.
Something that's maybe just
there's
happened.
There's something interesting here. Israel threatens another large-scale Gaza war.
Oh.
That came up today.
23rd of December 2009, Israel has threatened another massive war against the Gaza Strip as impoverished enclaves continue to suffer in the aftermath of a devastating January offensive. Israeli planes have been dropping thousands of leaflets across Gaza, warning Palestinians against cooperating with the resistance forces based in the coastal sliver.
Yeah. You want to go through more of that? Probably not.
No, that's probably
enough. Let's see. From Guantanamo to desk at Al Jazeera. Of the 779 known prisoners who have been held at Guantanamo Bay, Cuba, only one was a journalist. The journalist, Sami Al-Haj, was working for Al Jazeera as a cameraman when he was stopped by Pakistani forces on the border with Afghanistan in late 2001. Mr. Haj was never charged with a crime during his years in custody. Now, more than a year after his release, Mr. Haj, a 40-year-old native of Sudan, is back at work at the Arab Satellite News Network, leading a new desk devoted to human rights and public liberties. The captive has become the correspondent. That's great.
Good for him.
Yeah, let's read more about that. I think that's a good article.
It's been horrible. I wanted to talk for 7 years to make up for the 7 years of silence, Mr. Haj, through an interpreter during an interview at the network's headquarters in Doha, Qatar. Among Al Jazeera's viewers in the Arab world since the 9/11 attacks, perhaps nothing has damaged perceptions of America more than Guantanamo Bay. For that reason, Mr. Haj, who did a six-part series on the prison after his release, is a potent weapon for the network, which doesn't always strive for journalistic objectivity on the subject of his treatment. In an interview, Ahmed Sheikh, the editor-in-chief of Al Jazeera, called Mr. Haj one of the victims of human rights atrocities committed by the ex-U.S. administration. Mr. Haj has not restricted himself to Guantanamo and his own incarceration. He has expanded the network's coverage of other human rights issues, including press freedom in Iraq, Palestinians in Israel prisons, and the implications of the U.S. Patriot Act. On a Wednesday morning in mid-August, Mr. Haj pushed Al Jazeera's news desk to cover hunger strikes by political prisoners in Jordan, and he happily pointed to a nearby television where the Jordan news scrolled on the bottom of the screen. Nor has his experience radicalized him. He said that despite his upbringing in a violent and often repressive country and his experience in detention, he's maintained a sustaining belief in democracy and the rule of law. Let's see.
In prison.
Terry Anderson, an Associated Press correspondent who was detained in Lebanon from 1985 to 1991 by Islamic fundamentalists, said he could understand Mr. Haj's chosen assignment. In prison, what do? You think about your life, you think about what you were doing and how it led you here, Mr. Anderson said. Mr. Haj's story is well known to the Al Jazeera's viewers, but not to most Americans. As with the experiences of many detainees at Guantanamo Bay, his version is uncorroborated by American officials or any documents. After working in a beverage company and then trying to start a business in Azerbaijan, he began working as a cameraman for Al Jazeera in 2000. He was captured on December 15, 2001, trying to cross the border back into Afghanistan with his camera and a correspondent. He later came to believe that the Americans were seeking another Al Jazeera cameraman, one with a similar name who had recorded an interview with Osama bin Laden after the September 11th attacks. After being detained by local authorities in Pakistan, Mr. Hajj was transferred into American custody. He says, tortured and beaten at a prison in the Bagram Air Base in Afghanistan, he was moved to Kandahar and then transported to Guantanamo Bay in mid-2002. Looking back, he says he thinks he was sent there in part because he was a journalist. I've seen a lot of things that I shouldn't have seen, he said, citing the treatment of prisoners at Bagram in particular. Mr. Hajj claims that in lengthy interrogations, he was asked for details of the network staff, policies and processes, and that some guards started calling him Al Jazeera as a nickname. Excuse me. He said an interrogator once asked him, how much does Bin Laden pay Al Jazeera for all the propaganda that Al Jazeera supplies? You're asking the wrong question, he replied, emphasizing that Bin Laden was not a propaganda partner of Al Jazeera. He's a newsmaker. In American custody, he tried to keep practicing journalism, he said, writing eyewitness accounts for his lawyers and family members, interpreting a fellow detainee's stories of abuse, and even making drawings of force feedings during a hunger strike. I felt that I needed to document this for history, he said, so that the next generation knows the depth of the crime that was committed. He audibly emphasized the Arabic word for depth as he spoke. During the interview, Mr. Hajj displayed a deep wound on his left leg, which he said he suffered when he was pinned against cell bars during a beating at Guantanamo. He reiterated that the emotional trauma was more extensive than the physical. He says he continues to see psychotherapists. Asked about Al Jazeera, a Pentagon spokesman said members of the media are not targeted by U.S. forces, but there is no special category that gives members of a media organization's immunity if captured engaging in suspicious terror-related activity. The spokesman added that all detainees were treated humanely while in custody. According to Zachariah Kasnelson, the legal director for Reprieve, a human rights group that represented Mr. Hajj, the allegations changed over the years. First, he was alleged to have filmed an interview of Osama bin Laden. It was another cameraman. So that allegation disappeared. Then the U.S. said Sami ran a jihadist website. Turns out that there was no such site, so the allegations disappeared. Then the U.S. said Sami was in Afghanistan to arrange missile sales to the Chechen rebels. There was no evidence to back that up, so all the allegations disappeared. Mr. Hajj's release back to Sudan on a stretcher came in May on 2008 after lobbying by human rights groups and the government of Sudan. The Pentagon spokesman said that Mr. Hajj's release to Sudan indicated our belief that the government of Sudan could effectively mitigate the threat possessed by him. Since his release, he has put on weight and honed his rhetoric. He splits his time between Al Jazeera and the Guantanamo Justice Center, a group he co-founded for former detainees. Through the center, he's helping to prepare legal action against former President George W. Bush and officials of his administration. Even during a translated interview, he remained keenly sensitive to language, calling the detainees at Guantanamo captives, to call attention to what he says is a place outside of law. When a visitor mentioned enhanced interrogation techniques, an American term that characterizes harsh treatment of detainees, Mr. Hajj interrupted the interpreter and said in Arabic, instead of torture, we are giving the wrong impression with that term, he said. We as journalists are violating human rights because we are changing the perception of reality. Oddly, while in prison sanctioned by American authorities, Mr. Hajj put his face in the American political system. He gathered bits of nudes from guards, and leading up to the 2004 election, was sure that American voters would reject Mr. Bush, which would lead to his freedom. When the guards informed him that the president had been reelected, he was stunned. I was sure I would outlive Bush, he said.
Huh. Yeah, that's an amazing story, we wish him much luck. We'll see. Kind of strange. I don't know if you want to. Five held hostage at a rural Virginia post office. Who's it on the news tonight?
Mm-mm.
Authorities say as many as five people are being held hostage at a post office in a small town in Virginia. Wyatteville Mayor Trent Crew says five people are inside the building, including three employees and two customers. Crew said that shots had been fired, but no injuries have been reported. The Virginia State Police have responded with a SWAT team and bomb technician. A spokeswoman confirmed shots had been fired, but could not say whether explosives were involved. Let's see. Obamacare to cost middle-class families $15,000 a year.
Crippling new bill will lead to a rebellion by Paul Joseph Watson. Families struggling. Okay, let's go to that. Families struggling in the midst of a deep recession who earn a combined total greater than $88,200 and don't have their health care covered by their employer will be hit with a mandatory annual fee of about $15,000, according to the Congressional Budget Office analysis of the final Senate Obamacare bill. As we highlighted yesterday, the health care bill would introduce a raft of new taxes that would inevitably lead to higher costs than would be passed on to the public. A Boston Globe analysis revealed that there are at least 19 new taxes contained in the legislation, which is set to be passed on Christmas Eve. On top of this, a CBO analysis identifies five facts about the bill that will financially devastate families with annual income greater than the 400% of the federal poverty level. Under Obamacare, Americans will be forced to buy government-approved health insurance, and anyone earning a middle-class wage will have to pay for it out of their own pocket. Federal subsidies will only be provided for people who are not offered coverage by their employer and earn below the 400% poverty level. Employers will not be required to offer their workers coverage, being subject to a $750 annual penalty if they fail to do so, a figure most analysts say is not high enough to prevent employers from dropping their plans, meaning that more people will be forced to buy government health care. The Senate health care bill gives employers two powerful incentives to stop offering health insurance coverage to their workers, writes Terry Jeffrey. First, if the employer does offer coverage, its lower wage workers will lose their federal insurance subsidy they would otherwise get. Secondly, if an employer does not offer coverage, the $750 per worker fine it will face will be far less than the premiums it would pay if it did offer coverage. Costs are also set to soar as a result of insurance companies being hit with federal mandates that increase their risk.
Policies purchased through the exchange or directly from insurers would have to meet several requirements. In particular, insurers would have to accept all applicants, could not limit coverage for pre-existing medical conditions, and could not vary premiums to reflect differences in enrollees' health, according to the CBO. Excuse me. This will inevitably force insurance companies to pass higher costs onto the public. As a consequence of these factors, families whose employers drop their plan will be forced to buy it on their own at a cost of over $15,000 a year. The average premiums per policy in the non-group market would be roughly $5,800 for single policies and $15,200 for family policies under the proposal. Jeffrey predicts the families being hit with a federally mandated $15,000 a year insurance bill will provoke a rebellion. When that happens, the liberals will not say we made a mistake. We never should have forced families out of the employer-based insurance and required them to pay $15,000, right? They will say, we told you so. We cannot trust these greedy insurance companies, and we need a single-payer system so the government can provide health with health care, provide anyone health care, just like they did in the Soviet Union. So we got problems, guys. I mean, there's no doubt. I mean, they just got a whole bunch of problems. And that was from Prison Planet, Paul Joseph Watson. And, we got about a 40-minute interview with George. So we get on about 5 minutes.
Blackwater eyes Afghan contractor search. Virginia, December 2009, Virginian pilot. As the United States builds up its military presence in Afghanistan, mercenaries are flocking there in ever greater numbers. And XE, the company formerly known as Blackwater, is in the hunt to get a share of the new work. According to a report last week from the Congressional Research Service, there were about 64,000 uniformed U.S. troops in Afghanistan in September and 104,101 military contractors. 62% of the Defense Department work would force there.
Defense Department workforce.
Workforce there, yeah, 62%. Okay. The Obama administration planned deployment of 30,000 more troops in the coming months could require as many as 56,000 more contractors, the report estimated. XE, the Moyock, North Carolina-based terrorist organization, is already on the ground in Afghanistan despite its controversial history in Iraq, and it is in the running for additional contracts. So we call them contractors, and they're really... mercenaries.
Well, the thing is that military contractors, they could be, I don't know if that's armed contractors, or if a lot of those could be Halliburton, a lot of those could be...
They said mercenaries.
Mercenaries.
Yeah.
U.S. troops in Afghanistan, it says military contractors.
I think they call them contractors,
yeah,
but a lot of them, I don't know how they divide those up.
If that's mercenaries, there's 170,000 men over there, you know, fighting people. So,
and what they're doing, who God only knows.
Yeah, and they've got a free hand. Let's see, Lithuania hosted at two secret CIA prisons. Lithuanian inquiry has found that the U.S. Central Intelligence Agency set up and used secret prisons on its soil following the September 11, 2001 terror attacks in the U.S. Lithuania Intelligence Agency assisted the CIA-run secret prisons and were used to hold at least eight al-Qaeda suspects. The parliamentary panel in charge of the probe said the report on Tuesday. The National Security Committee reports records instances in 2005 and 2006 that chartered planes were allowed to land in Lithuania, adding that all the Lithuanian officials, including President, I can't pronounce his name, were kept in the dark about the aircraft's passengers.
Huh.
And then about those that, I think about it. Yeah, you know, this bugs me, and what bothers me is the agitation of Iran lately, and they're going Now, this is kind of interesting. Iran identifies 80 subversive foreign institutes. One of these institutes has allocated a $1.7 billion budget. Iranian intelligence minister Hadi Moshli says dozens of foreign organizations have attempted to create havoc in Islamic Republic have been identified. During the seditious efforts, various NGOs were cited. To date, 80 foreign institutions, foundations, and funds that are active in this process have been identified. The Far News Agency quoted Moshlihi as saying on Tuesday. He noted that the leaders of the sedition effort tried to propagate the idea that Iran's 2009 presidential election was rigged in order to encourage acts of civil disobedience. And I want to read that. That's what's been planned for since Bush started this thing.
And that's what they're doing in Venezuela.
Right. What is this? Okay, there's a budget. Iran's intelligence state. Oh, okay. So that was it.
That was about it.
That was it. Okay. There's another interesting one.
Ahmadinejad, Iranian President Mahmoud Ahmadinejad says the U.S. will definitely fail in the Middle East as the regional nations will not allow it to dominate the region. Addressing people in the southern city of Shiraz on Tuesday, President Ahmadinejad said Iran strongly opposes U.S. plans to spread its dominance in the region. The problem is that the U.S. seeks to dominate the Middle East, but the Iranian nation is an obstacle. President Ahmadinejad said, adding that issues such as Iran's nuclear program and human rights were nothing but mere pretext. The nuclear game is repetitious, old-fashioned, and boring. Say publicly that you are seeking dominance over the Middle East, but Iran does not allow you to do so. But the world should know that the Iranian nation and the regional countries will make it impossible for the U.S. to dominate in the Middle East, the president noted.
On Iran's nuclear issue, President Ahmadinejad rejected outright the allegation that Tehran was making nuclear bombs. He said if wanted, Iran could build bombs, which it did not, adding that the Iranian nation could stand firm on whatsoever it has announced till it achieves it. You should know that if we wanted to build bombs, we have enough courage to announce that we are making bombs. And we have a great and brave nation. We told you that we will launch the nuclear fuel cycle, and we did it. We told you that we will industrialize the fuel of production, and we did it. And we told you that we will launch a new generation of centrifuges, and we did. And that's what, and that's Iran's reply. So, to the allegations, I thought they were going to name the those 80 institutions, but they didn't. You know what I mean? I was hoping they'd name a few more. Well,
they're hoping that the American public forgets.
Who?
The leader.
The leader, which, what are you talking
about? Well, they're hoping that our focus, the United States government hopes that our focus goes off this and onto something else.
Oh, yeah, sure.
Yeah,
course,
we don't retain
absolutely.
Yeah.
We're like gnats. I mean, we get the memory of gnats. We don't remember anything.
Yeah, it just goes off that and onto something else, that's all.
That's why I wrote this book, Naked at the Mic. And the reason I did is because it had so many facts and figures and things that we covered on our radio shows and the documentaries we did, and Lila and I followed through the last 10 years, you know, of political changes, and being at the tip at the at kind of the at a broadcaster's edge, if you will, through that whole thing, and we witnessed it, and we witnessed the protests, we witnessed the political candidates, we interviewed the political candidates, we interviewed the activists involved, the anti-war activists. So our stories are interesting, but our stories are true. And and you can check that out at Naked at the Mic. The Survival of a Liberal in a Time of Peril. That's the name of our book. And we will, it should be out in a few weeks. So we'll announce it, of course. Let's go to, I want to thank everybody here, and we're going to go to the, right away to the,
to the interview.
To the interview. And that is by, that interview was with George Dixon. And we're going to start it right now.
Okay, I think you'll find it informative.
Yeah.
So stay tuned.
There it is. We should.
Can we get that on the show?
Play it. Yes, we
Hopefully
can.
Hopefully it'll play.
Yes, we can.
Correctly. Oh, I hope so.
I hope so. All right, and this is our interview with George Dixon.
Hello, Leo.
Hi, George. How are you?
I'm fine, Lila. How are you, my dear?
I'm fine, thank you. Welcome
happy
to
Christmas.
Oh, happy Christmas to you. Now, welcome to the show.
Well, thank you. It's a nice time of year.
Oh, it is.
Hey, George, what do you make of we just hit the solstice yesterday, so I thought you might maybe give a little background on what Christmas is, where it comes from. Not the Christ thing, but leading up to the Christ thing.
Well, it's it's utilizing a natural occurrence that happens every year. as the winter solstice.
Right, the solstice,
it's
right.
It's the longest day of the Earth, but also it's a point where, you know, in the wobble of the Earth, with the axis toward the sun, we're shifted. But we're at a point where we're actually, we stop our motion in the sky, if you'd want to call it that, and we reverse it and go the opposite direction. But for stop, I mean where we stop our course in the sky, and for all intents and purposes, we actually stop for 3 days, and we continue to go forward.
Right, which really symbolizes the 3 days of Christ in the tomb, you know, the 3 days of whatever holiness. And you know, it all points to the resurrection. Is that correct?
Yes. I mean, you're cutting in and out of. I'm losing you.
Oh well, I'm sorry about that. I don't know what.
Okay.
So what I was saying is that a lot of it has to do. I mean, Christ is an icon basically for Horus, which was an icon for I forget who was before Horus, Nebuchadnezzar. I believe was considered a virgin birth or something. This goes back a long way.
The legend goes back. It's
into many cultures. Mm-hmm. This Christ virgin childbirth type of thing. Is that correct, George?
Yes. Well, you know, even to go back to the Egyptian times,
right,
with King Tut. King Tut supposedly was a prodigal son. But what happened is that it fell through, and it didn't mature to the point where the elders wanted it to be. And it wasn't until 1,000 years later where the Christo manifestation came into being.
Right.
And that's with Jesus and Mary and Joseph.
Hmm. So, but if you look at the historical aspects of this, you know, prior to Christ and prior to you've had a number of virgin births.
A number of cultures have used the same idea.
The same legend or the same
mm-hmm.
Type of story. But all it does essentially is, again, creates a mystical relation between the solstice and their religion or their god or their, you know, prophet or whatever their manifestation of divinity is. But what's your take on this, George?
Well, it's the birthing of an idea of a concept, and if nothing else, the idea of the Christo manifestation was the salvation for its followers. Just
yeah.
Like Isis and Osiris, Horus basically was the
Christ-like son. Yeah. So, I guess what I'm getting at, which is what I wanted to get at, was how does this rebirth, if you will, that happens every solstice, how does that relate to the Mayan calendar sixth night at this point? How can we look at this? We've only based on the Mayan calendar. 2012, okay, the solstice, December 21st, 2012 is the final solstice.
Yes.
It's the end of the world.
In this period, or in this age period.
In this age period.
Right.
Okay.
And it's the ending of a period that started, the last start on this period was 3114 B.C. for the Mayans.
Mm-hmm.
We just left the Pisces period and we're going into the Aquarian period. Is that correct?
Okay.
Is that right? Or do you remember?
Well, yes, but that's in the position of the equinox.
Correct.
That's our position where we move 1 degree every 26,000 years in an elliptical orbit of 306 degrees. It takes us 26,000 years to move 1 degree, in that movement.
Right.
But what's happening is that that 1 degree now is taking us into a different age period, which is the age of Aquarius.
But that also leads us to, on that 26,000 years, leads to a polar shift. Is that correct? Because
well, fellowships are experienced, but it's not that the fellowships are just part of the experience. You know, of the cycle.
Of the actual cycle, right?
Right.
But it's one of the hallmark trademarks, if you will, or symptoms of that 26,000 year. Actually, 25,920, I believe it is.
Well, it's one of the symptoms, but you know, this has happened before. Just like since this period began, the last period with the Mayans, 3114 BC. There has been a shift, the polar shift, but not really the polar shift, but the stopping of the Earth, and then it's starting again in the same direction.
Right.
Now, in 9172 BC, we had the last polar shift, but also it was a shift of the movement of the Earth instead of revolving east to west and revolve west to east. And that happened 9772 BC. And then it happened again I'm not sure in the date, but around 3000 BC, where the Earth stopped for 72 hours, or for 24 hours, and then it starts spinning again in the same direction.
Wow, it does start turning in the opposite direction. But
Sometimes that does happen, and sometimes it doesn't. That's been recorded, I think, 14 times in the last 25 million years, that it does reverse the direction. But it doesn't happen every time it stops like that.
That's kind of strange. You'd think it would, but it doesn't.
So what does that cause? What happens on the Earth? What is the effect on the Earth when that happens?
All kinds of effects. First of all, is the alignment of the alignment of the gravity.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know how that works out, but you know, it's just like watching water go down in a toilet. You know, it revolves to the right.
Yep.
And yet, in the southern hemisphere, it revolves to the left. And actually, it's reversing the direction of energy.
So when you get that polar shift, then does it change? It changes course.
Right, it does.
Changes direction as it goes down.
They've recorded. Scientists have found evidence that you know when a polar shift does take place, that the Earth stops and then everything continues to move for a period of time. Then it is actually just ripped apart. And then it goes in the opposite direction.
Yeah, I saw an article today that said the volcano under Old Faithful, all right,
mm-hmm.
is they've exposed it somehow. They were able to see how big that geyser was and how large that molten mass is that lies under there. And they found that they said if this ever blows, it's going to be overwhelming. I mean, it would do massive continental devastation. You know? Did you hear me, George?
Yes.
Yeah.
You're fading in and out. I don't know if it's the reception on the radio or telephone or not.
No, it's probably the telephone here. But anyway, I wanted to say that. Forget about it. I kind of forgot what I was.
You
saying.
You were talking about the volcano under Old Faithful.
Yeah, I read that the volcano under Old Faithful was. So large, okay, that much larger than they ever expected it to be, and they were able to discover the actual core of that, and they found that it was so massive that it could do continental damage if it ever erupted.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
It might erupt. I was wondering when the Earth changes direction, like you were mentioning, it has to stop, right, before it changes direction.
Yes.
So that would cause huge problems.
Well, it would. It has. But a lot of people believe that what happens is that once it turns in the opposite direction, that you know it would kill life or it would tear life apart, which it would do. But we know for a fact that we've survived that type of cataclysm. And like I was saying before, we have scientific evidence that the Earth stopped and then it revolved in the opposite direction We have the geological evidence for that.
To prove that that did happen.
Yes, but as we also have found mammoths instantly frozen, you know, with food particles in their mouth and in their stomach. And, you know, they were found instantly frozen, you know, by this move and so forth.
Wow.
But we have been able to survive this, and it's not as destructive as it sounds or as people have let it up to be. We do get through this. How we get through it, I don't know.
On Noah's Ark.
Yeah, or find caves in some place where, you know, we're not going to be hurt by flying debris that's going to be blown around. But, you know, the concept of the idea was used by the Christian religion, I think, in formulating, you know, the understanding of the Christal manifestation was making room for the prodigal son to come in and bring salvation, you know, for the sins of the world, if you'd want to call it that, but raise humanity up a level a notch into a more secure or a unity-type connection with the God principle, and that's the God of the God of their forefathers.
Right.
Just like with Christians, it wasn't a Christian belief, it was a Jewish belief, and the Jewish want for salvation, along with the Muslims or the Islamic world.
Well, they're all, those three major religions are all descended from Abraham.
That's correct, yes.
And we all have the same founding, and we all believe in the one true God.
Yes.
So those three religions, even though they have spent eternity, it seems, fighting against each other, have so much in common. They grew from the same seed.
It's kind of like siblings, you know.
Yes.
Yeah.
That's what it is.
The warring triplets.
Yeah.
Very sad. Or siblings,
one,
more. Yeah.
Yeah, siblings. I mean, there's four.
Three major religions.
Right. But, mm-hmm. Yeah, then there are others. So we, So anyway, I was just wondering, George, maybe you could fill some of the people in on the Mayan calendar. A lot of people may be tuning in right now and wondering what the hell is he talking about if they haven't followed our shows. But if you could just take a few seconds and minutes and just explain to our listeners where we're at right now and how what the Mayan calendar actually represents and how we got to 2012 and why that's such a significant date.
Well,
I know, okay. Do it all in 1 minute.
All in 1 minute.
Yeah, nothing like putting our friend on the spot, right? Huh?
Well, what I can say is that the Mayans also had a belief for a prodigal son who was going to come and save them, which is Quetzalcoatl of the Mayans, who was a white-bearded man who was going to come and bring salvation, you know, to the Mayan people, or reunite them, you know, with the God principle of the sun god.
Mm-hmm.
And it's through the sun god that they were able to rise themselves or rise this dimensional reality and join the Creator, just like the Christian belief of you know joining with a God or becoming God.
Mm-hmm.
And
it's funny, it was that belief that got them conquered.
That's true. But understand that, you know, all this at the same time period was the same time that Quetzalcoatl actually came to the Mayan people.
Oh, wow. Yeah.
The Mayan calendar talks about
that.
The evolution of consciousness that we are to experience, even though that was back in the early ADs, you know, well, the first century AD, is when the formulation of this concept of salvation, you know, for to be saved, or having an outsider come and save us, came into existence. But it's not only the existence of thought, but the actual event actually happened. Like it was put into the records, or the cosmic records, if you'd want to call it that.
Right, right.
You know, from different belief systems, different groups of people have the same focus and belief, but it was only through the experience that they finalized it, or they made it real. Not something that was imaginary, but it was formulated and put in the Akashic records as it actually happened. And just like I was saying before with the Egyptians, first of all, you had Isis and Osiris, who had Horus, who was the prodigal son. And if you go later on in the Egyptian lineage, you have Akhenaten, who was married to Queen Nefertiti. And it's through that family unit that they produced the King Tut. And King Tut was supposedly the prodigal son, as Jesus would have been, but apparently that did not go through and it did not manifest as they wanted, because there was problems with politics and religious favoritism and so forth that, you know, they had way back then. I mean, we have the same thing nowadays.
But I think it's important to recognize, too, that one another thing is that Nefertiti and Akhenaten and that those people were all blue-blooded. They were all had Rh-negative blood.
Yes.
All right, and they were related to a Martian race. All right,
yeah.
Or they were the Martian race. And the fascinating thing about this was the size of their heads. They all had these large kind of skulls that protruded backwards or upwards, and almost like cone heads, you know. And old statues of them and pictures of them, it all showed this as part of and that's why they wore those large pharaoh headdresses, right, and so on, to disguise, or actually
the shape
of their heads. And they were very tall. They were 14 feet tall, 13 feet tall, that kind of thing.
Well, that's correct. But see, what they tried to do is bring back the blue blood lineage at the time.
That's right, yeah.
And understand that, Akhenaten and Nefertiti, they had Syrian blood within their...
right.
Within them. Or they were basically Assyrians. And they were taller beings. In fact, they had... they had 24 chromosomes compared with our 23.
But they were also, they were, being Assyrian, they were from the planet Sirius.
That's right.
That's, you know, so they were different in that respect, but they were, but the others were different as well. I mean, we had a series of, we still do, I'm sure, a series of visitors who inhabited our Earth and organized our civilizations as we know them today.
Yeah, I just got to flip over this tape, and I hope you're still enjoying.
Thing of DNA that was done by the Anunnaki,
right?
Which were a race of beings from a planet within our solar system, but in a large elliptical orbit. They call it the 12th planet.
Or Nibiru.
Zechariah Sitchin, who has written a series of books called The Earth Chronicles, he talks about this race of people who conquered our planet thousands of years ago.
And this wasn't science fiction. I mean, this was all based on the Sumerian tablets.
That's correct.
That he was able to decode.
Mm-hmm.
That's
and,
right.
And found those are 25,000-year-old tablets. So,
Yeah, these tablets go way, way back.
And they were, and then they were looted from Iraq. They joined the Iraq War and invasion, and they were looted from the Iraqi prison, Iraqi museum, and stolen, totally taken out of there and stolen, and over 10,000 tablets, all right, were missing.
Well, let's explain to the audience here, understanding that. This planet, Nibiru, the Anunnaki, when it came every
3,600 years.
1,000 years or so, they would come by the Earth. For 3,600 years, they would come by the Earth, they would touch base with us, like the humanoid or the Adam and Eve culture.
Right.
What I was saying before is that you take a look at their connection along with the Syrians. The Syrian was another race of beings that were part of that genetic manipulating that we experienced. And what it was two different bloods, two different makeups, who were put into one. And from a conceptual point of view, the Anunnaki was our mothers, the female mothers, and the Syrians were our fathers, because that basically is of the genetic makeup came from the Syrian race. Now, the Syrian's son, Sirius, is a sister son to our son here in our solar system. And if you take a look at the movement that our sun and solar system make in the Milky Way, it is a dual sun of Sirius. We move together. In fact, our movement duplicates the DNA spiral in our DNA. And it's part of the relationship, the energy relationship that we have, our sun, with the Sirius sun. And also, it's from the life forms, so from that energy field. And that's why the Syrians were brought into let's say the genetic manipulating. And I want to continue back with the Egyptians. When you were mentioning that these Egyptians had large head and that they were tall, yes, they were. But it was the last basic time that the Syrians directly with us humanoid or the Adam and Eve seeds that came out of that genetic manipulating.
Right, because the skeletons, the size of the bodies, the human body was much smaller, but the head was much smaller as well. It didn't have that oblong shape to it. You know? There, George? Yeah. Well, anyway, what I was going to ask you again, that was good. What I wanted to do is just before we close tonight, I wanted to ask you just a little bit more about where we're at here with the Mayan, with the sixth night of the Mayan calendar. How we what are we looking forward to here? This is the time of that empires fall. It's the time of great upheaval and change. And as all starts to collapse, we can know that by the end of this period, which ends on the, November 2010, George?
Yes, the early part of November 5th, I think, 2010.
Right. So November 5th, we enter the seventh day of the universal period.
Yes.
Which is when we are to start beginning to co-create the universe, you know?
That's right. Well, what we're doing right now is the night period that we're in, is that we are co-creating in our fantasy where we want to be or where we want to go. And it's actually creating reality. We're creating a reality that we want for ourselves, let's say, a year from now. But in order for us to replace it, we have to close out or bring to a close,
all our past, yeah.
But the direction that we have been going in, or where we've been led to, at this point, of course, from a global point of view, financially, you know, we are making some changes, but it's actually putting to rest all the old ways and making way for new ways, and those new ways now have come through us, I think, to the accomplishments that we've been able to. Bring to the surface in the last year or so forth, but it's implementing those changes into our lives. Or it's a time that we've experienced that we want a new life, or we want something different. But now it's a period where we actually put it to rest and adapt our new beliefs or our new wants.
And
in November of 2010 is where we'll be at that point where we've changed things around. And we're starting a new life, or we're living a new life. Right now, we're experiencing new surroundings or a new understanding of the world, and we're changing as it's changing us. But in another year or so forth, we'll be able to have a clearer picture of where we are and see more directly where we're going. And it's where we're going that we're going to experience. It's a beautiful time, but right now we're at a time where we're bringing things to a rest or bringing things to a close, and that's the sad part because it's ending of old ways of living and starting new ways, which is scary, but it's it's also frightening, I think, in the unpredictable ways things are working out. Nothing is predictable, and yet everything is predictable. But we have been at a time where nothing is real, but everything is real, and that's what the Mayans told us, that we would be experiencing a time where we can experience everything, but yet we're not experiencing nothing at all because it's one big illusion.
Well, what we're doing is we're ascending to a fourth-dimensional level. I think we're becoming aware of that level that exists, and many are passing through. As they concentrate on their future, they place themselves in that fourth-dimensional state continually. The only difference is that time's speeding up the way it has. By next year, we'll begin to see all of the things that we dreamed of, basically, that year, then in that universal period, that's when everything will manifest, and we will be headed to a wholly different dimensional existence. All right. It's very difficult to explain to those who haven't heard of it before or studied it, but or been there. But the fourth dimension is does exist, and it is in our capacity to embrace.
Yeah, I felt that way.
Yeah, well, okay, a spider and fell down beside her. Yeah, you were seriously...
I was in peril there, but my life was saved, George.
With the Mayans and the
Christian beliefs, because they parallel each other, they really do. One understanding that we're experiencing right now in this period that we're in, which is in the sixth night, is where now our dreams or are manifesting themselves not only from a mental image, but also from a physical image too.
Yeah.
And it's where your heart is, where your focus is, in your heart's direction, is it's going to manifest if you like it or not.
Well, it's not quite different.
This is actually uniting the mental mind with the emotional mind or the emotional body and manifesting itself. And that's through the imagination or through your imagination or your dreams. There's two ways in facing the world as an outsider or as an actual participant in the illusion. And right now we are experiencing reality from our very core, and that's how we experience life.
Mm-hmm.
All I can say is that part of this Christmas spirit is uniting the physical body, the soul, with the emotional aspect of the heart.
Yeah, and you know, there's another aspect of this too that Christmas that always amazed me is that period not only of brotherliness and kindness to one another, that kind of thing, but also the instant manifestation, if you will, of the surprise of Christmas gifts. You know what I mean? Like everybody hopes for something they want, you know, and maybe dreams of something they want. It tells their parents, I want this rocket ship, or I want this race car, or I want this book, or I want this pony, or I want something. And a parent goes out and wants to surprise and wants to, create that gift for their child, and or for their spouse, or for their parents, or their sisters, brothers, whatever it is, maybe. But it's a time. It's a very special time in that. If you wish upon a star, it'll come true, you know, during this period. And I think that's something that we all hope for, and that's why everybody prays for a new beginning, and, you know, the solstice is that period. And we move on and into a new world. And I think that's going to be where we're headed. I think we're all pushing on to the fourth dimensional state. I think that's where everybody wants to get. And hopefully by the end of next year, everybody will be there. So that next Christmas, right, will be a magical, magical time. And we're hoping for that.
Well, I don't know if we're going to be there in a year or so.
Oh, we'll be there. It'll be better and better each year, I'm sure. You know,
well, it's going to be better until we reach that goal, but it's not going to be... And for another couple of years where that's going to matter.
Well, yeah, 2012, but every year, next year and the year after, will be better and better and better. I mean, as we get closer and closer and closer to our ability to transcend, you know, into that fourth dimensional state. And as people begin to understand it. I was thinking today of it, it was like it's kind of like the 100 monkey syndrome, you know what I mean? Where eventually, after 99, that 100th person just descends without, you know, having to be taught. It's just, they're just suddenly there. They're on a contact high. You know what I mean? Do you hear me?
Yes. Yes.
So,
well, you know,
George, if you can just wait one second, I just got to give this ID. This is WQQQ 103.3 FM in Sharon, Lakeville, and Millington, and you're listening to the Ellie Steele Show. And we are talking right now with our famous esoteric researcher and lecturer, Mr. George Dixon, and a regular on our Friday night internet show. How's that, George?
Well, you know,
was that a pretty good intro?
There you go.
I've been working on it. You know,
I just look at it as I'm just an ordinary guy trying to find the truth or trying to understand what it's all about.
Yeah.
But you know, understanding this salvation, understanding this is something fairly new. This is only brought into our belief system, you know, in the last 12,000, 15,000 years.
Right.
But this salvation is all it is actually reconnecting with the God principle, or the source of light, and experiencing it for what it is, and understanding that we were thrown into the dark about 12,000 years ago, where we are closed off to the world, and the only way we could experience the world is through the mental understanding that we've been able to build up by, you know, what we've learned. What we are to experience is reconnecting the other half of our connections with this life, and that's our emotional body, and that is connecting with our heart. So now it's connecting. It's not only connecting with the knowledge, but it's connecting with the heart, which is an instant connection with everything that that is going on.
Well,
it's through our living, our understanding now, the only way we could find out about the outside world is by what we've preceded the out world to be, because we've been closed off from the outside world. Once we connect with the outside world, we connect to it through the emotional body, through the emotional body, which is instantaneous, and that's what the Christo belief system was all about, was connecting with the world not only mentally but also physically, emotionally, and that's what this whole salvation experience has been, in reconnecting ourselves with the whole, not only half of ourself or our ability to conceive, but our whole ability of not only conceiving it but also experiencing it by feeling it. And the idea of the Christ or Jesus coming was an actual human body or human person who's experienced not only the mental life, but also the emotional life of, let's say, of a human being, is something that connects everybody to the same properties of emotions and of feelings toward one another, and that's love.
Well, we certainly could use a lot more of that in the world.
And that's where we—that's kind of got where we got to end tonight, there, George. And
there we go.
Great word to end on. And we wish you and your family a really good. I was going to say Thanksgiving, but we just passed that.
Happy Christmas.
Merry Christmas. And thanks for being on, George.
And we'll talk to you real soon.
I will. Thank you. God be with you, folks, and thank you again, and Merry Christmas.
All right, Bill.
And you too. That was George Dixon talking to us tonight on the Mayan calendar and ascension consciousness.
And the significance of Christmas
in relation to that.
So we're going to go away for a little while, and I've got something special for you. I got a special song by Tom Waite, and I got lucky I'll be able to hook up with a 5-minute interview with him on from David Letterman show. Back in 2002, it's kind of good. So if you bear with me, we will be there in a second. And this is by Tom Waits.
Romeo, if they only had a gut. Romeo was bleeding tonight. now and then. He leans against the guard or feel the blood in his shoes. I'm a clown at a fireplace at the fourth of the storm. And Romeo starts his engines, wipes the blood off the door. Hey, Booty, shoot the signal. He got the radio full blast. And they all try to stand like Romeo. And the moon's cut like a sickle. You can hear him talking in Spanish. All about their hero. Hey, Pachuco. Hey, man. My sister. Hey, man. Romeo is bleeding. Oh, Romeo is bleeding. I get the fact that Romeo is bleeding.
Enjoyed that the show with George Dixon. I threw on that extra Tom Waits, which I did play last night on the FM radio show. And I want to thank everybody for listening tonight. I hope you have a really good Christmas. We'll be off tomorrow and Friday, and of course, New Year's Day and New Year's Eve. But I want to thank you all, and please, I hope you enjoy this show as our Christmas show. And have a pleasant evening. And as George said, it all relates to love and brotherhood and kindness to everyone this time of year. And good night.